came to realize that what started out as a natural disaster became a man-made disaster.
We cannot control the natural disaster, but what we can do is control our response.
Have you ever wondered whether disasters are actually natural? If so, you're in the right place.
Hello and welcome. My name is Jason von Medding.
And I am Ksenia Chmutina.
This is Disasters Deconstructed, a podcast where we examine why disasters really happen.
Thank you for tuning in.
Dawn is breaking on a rainy monsoon morning in Fugam, a small settlement of around 75 households in Annapurna rural municipality in Meghdi district in western central Nepal. Fugam is located on a steep hillside above the Beni Jomsun Road and the powerful Kali Gandaki River that passes through on its course from the glaciated Nepal-Tibet borderlands to the Gangetic plains of northern India. On a clear day, you can see the peak of Annapurna Himal peering over the high hills surrounding Fugam. But in the monsoon months, Annapurna is hidden by a curtain of rain and clouds. While the rain lasts, no one living in Fugam sleeps easily. Fugam is a mixed settlement consisting of diverse ethnic and caste communities, with the indigenous Magar being the largest among them. The community is primarily dependent on agriculture and livestock rearing, while an increasing number of people are engaged in foreign labor migration to the Gulf, Malaysia, and other countries. The oral history of Fugam reveals that the community has been living on this landscape for over three generations. With the community's intergenerational tie to the land and having practiced agriculture, foraging, livestock raiding on this hillside for many generations, residents know the slopes, streams and pasture of Fugam well. During the rainy months from Chaste and Asuj, or June to September, the villagers are watchful for landslides. This landslide can come at any time and take many forms. Debris is often carried down in many stream channels at speed. Rocks fall from the cliff faces and land moves downward at the ridge line surrounding the village. The residents of Fugam worry that they will miss the road of a coming landslide while they are asleep, as the heavy rain falls loudly on their tin roofs, deafening them to other sounds and dangers. Landslides are difficult hazard to predict, and this has implications for how landslide hazard and risks are managed. Disaster risk management is a sensitive political issue across Nepal. Just a few months after the 2015 Gorkha earthquake, Nepal promulgated the new federal democratic secular constitution, which devolve political authority to local administrative units or municipality such as Annapurna Gaonpalika here. Local, provincial and federal government have been tasked with forming individual disaster risk management committees, which oversees the creation and implementation of disaster risk management plans. However, it is often not clear what can be done to manage the risks faced and the idea of spending limited budgets on the disaster that may or may not happen is typically ill-conceived by voters. Perhaps, unsurprisingly, much of the resources is spent on response rather than the risk reduction. Here in Fugam and elsewhere in Nepal's mid-hills, those who have economic means or keen connections will often choose to move out of their village for the monsoon season or especially during the time of heavy rain. But many residents stay despite the fear of landslide, as they have nowhere else to go. This brief example from Pagan sets the scene for the conversation that we will be having over the next 3 episodes of the Disaster Deconstructed podcast.
Hi, I'm Nima Dorje Bhutia.
Hello, I'm Tegwado.
I'm Anuradha Puri.
And I'm Deepak Pasnet. And together we are research associates from Social Science Baha in Kathmandu, Nepal, studying how communities in Nepal's middle hills negotiate changing physical and political landscapes to reduce risks from cascading mountain hazards in their local environments. We do this work as a part of a project funded by the UK's Global Challenge Research Fund called Sajak Nepal, or Aware Nepal in English. This research project is a multinational partnership of universities, research organizations, and government agencies across the UK, Nepal, Canada, and New Zealand, which is bringing new scientific knowledge about cascading mountain hazards into conversation with indigenous and local knowledges about mountain hazards from the Nepal Himalaya. Our goal is to generate novel intercultural and interdisciplinary methods for improving understanding of mountain hazards and create pathways for such information to reach communities that need them most. In doing so, we aim to support better decision-making around disaster risks across Nepal, building from our researchers' long-term relationship with communities and national and international governmental organizations.
When you're late, allow to eat once. It seems like we have a lot to do.
Well, we don't do it all ourselves. We have a big team. How many people are on the Sajak project?
We are more than 50, at least 30 in Nepal, and we are 5 at Social Science Baha. There's even, can you tell our listener who you are and how Social Science Baha is contributing to the Sajak Nepal project? This is for Disaster Deconstructed podcast.
Hi, my name is Jeevan and I am the assistant director at Social Science Baha. Social Science Baha is a research organization based in Kathmandu. We work together with a wider team of natural and social scientists, policymakers, and practitioners to develop the Sajak Nepal proposal in the beginning. So Social Science Baha is one of the partner organizations of the Sajak Nepal project. So in Sajak Nepal project, we have one work package co-lead, which is me, and we have another co-investigator, Dr. Mukta Singh Lama, and we have 4 other researchers, Anuradha, Deepak, Anima, and Tech. Right now, I'm sitting with our 4 Sajak team members at our canteen at Social Science Baha. It is a community space where all the Social Science Baha researchers and staff meet for lunch and also catch up with each other. I haven't seen all our researchers together in a few weeks because Nima and Deepak have only returned from 2 weeks in Annapurna municipality, one of the research sites. I also came back earlier in this week from visiting one of the Sajapil sites in Vimeshwar municipality with Anuradha. We were there to observe local government planning around disaster risk reduction.
Yes, most people think of the monsoon as a time to slow down, but it is actually a very busy time for us, isn't it, Dick?
Right. In the hills, people are busy planting and tending to rice paddy on their irrigated fields and performing sacred rituals, asking their land deities to protect them during the monsoons and coming year. Meanwhile, the elected officials are busy performing budget plans to support their annual work. And the scientists are busy monitoring hill slopes for signs of landslide. We're observing all these activities as part of the Sajak Nepal. So we are in and out of our main office in Kathmandu all monsoon season.
For the podcast series, we want to take you, our listeners, with us to some of our field sites, like Annapurna, where I work as co-lead researcher along with Jeevan.
And also to Vodekosi, where I work as a co-lead researcher along with the geographer, Dr. Katie Ova.
And we'll also take you to meet with our team members on the Sajak project, such as anthropologist Dr. Mukta Tamil,
who I work with is co-lead researchers in Tamil and postdoctoral research fellows, Dr. Amy Johnson.
And our geomorphology and geology colleagues at Trivandrum University, the National Society for Earthquake Technology, NSAIT, and Durham University.
This is a three-part series, right?
Right. For the first episode, we will be introducing our listeners to the SOJAK project and our approach to studying cascading mountain hazards in an interdisciplinary and intercultural way.
The second episode will focus more on how scientists and communities participating in the SOJAK Nepal project anticipate landslide and other risks that happen in the monsoon seasons. What are the different knowledges generated in this landscape by scientists and community members? What does their interactions teach us about how to live with landslide in Nepal's middle hills?
The third episode is going to take place during a knowledge exchange workshop held between landslide scientists on the SOJAK project and community members in Vatikosi in north central Nepal. I'm very much excited about it.
That way, we hope you can get a detailed view of how knowledge about cascading hazards are being produced in our research field and stakes of that knowledge for the communities that are living with landslides and other mountain hazards.
Let's ask Katie and Amy to explain. Are you ready to start, Call Nima?
Sure.
Welcome, Hemi and Katie, to this episode. We are glad to have you. Before we talk more about the project, can you both introduce yourself to our listeners?
I don't mind going first. Hi, Deepak, and hi, Nima. It's so good to be here, and hi, Katie. So I'm Amy Johnson, everyone. I'm an anthropologist of environmental and political change, and I'm currently based at Georgia College and State University as an assistant professor of anthropology. And I worked on the SOJAK Nepal project for the last 2.5 years, and I'm really close with the ethnographic research that was carried out and it continues to be carried out for the project.
Yeah, hi everyone. Thank you very much for inviting us along. So I'm Katie Oven, and I'm an associate professor at Northumbria University in the Department of Geography and Environmental Sciences. And I'm also affiliated with the Centre for Global Development at Northumbria. And I'm a geographer by training, and I work very much at the interface between human and physical geography that we're going to talk about today. And together with Jeevan at the Social Science Baha, I co-lead the first work package within the SOJAK and Nepal projects, which you're going to be hearing about over the next 3 podcasts.
Thank you, Katie and Amy, for introducing yourselves to our listener. As SOJAK Nepal is an interdisciplinary and intercultural research project, can you share your experience and understanding of interdisciplinary and intercultural research, and also share how it differs from the traditional research approaches?
Katie, why don't you start with interdisciplinary research?
Sure. Yeah, okay. So I guess for me, interdisciplinary research is about moving and working beyond a single discipline. It's about researchers from different disciplines working together, bringing different expertise and perspectives to bear on a problem and really complementing each other with those different expertise and understandings. So in the case of SOJAK Nepal, we're a team of natural and social scientists, of humanities scholars, as well as practitioners, policymakers, and of course, and most importantly, the communities we're working with also. And we're working together with the aim of reducing the impacts of mountain hazards. I think quite an important point that I'd say from the beginning when we think about interdisciplinarity is there could be a difference between more shallow interdisciplinarity or deep interdisciplinarity. And our project itself brings together disciplines that are fundamentally different. So across the natural and social sciences, for example, with the aim of really working together and moving beyond basic science, as people like scholars like Rigg and Mason talk about basic science, to actually do something much bigger, more applied science that we hope will be useful for the people we're working with.
Yeah, and I would build off of that and say that when I think about intercultural research, similarly, I'm thinking about crossing boundaries between different ways of knowing. And a lot of models that have been popularized in the sciences over the last couple of decades have been about bridging knowledges across different communities and cultures and meeting in the middle for a knowledge exchange. So like an X, there's like a meeting point. And for me, intercultural research is much more about a dialogue or a conversation that takes seriously different points of view and comes together to discuss a set of problems or issues. And similar to the deep interdisciplinarity that Katie was describing there, really ask people to move beyond what they're familiar with and try to operationalize a different way of knowing in order to reach a different level of understanding about a problem or an issue, and taking all of those points of views as serious beginnings. So for me, intercultural research has a real potential to push us beyond what we think we know about a given set of problems or issues. And in our case, about the meaning of disaster and how people live in landscapes that are subject to all kinds of different disaster contexts.
Thank you both for sharing your experience. Since Nima and I are both part of this interdisciplinary research, it has been a great opportunity to work and learn from other colleagues from different disciplines. But I would like to know how incorporating interdisciplinary and intercultural approach enhances the quality of research conducted in this research project. And would you mind sharing any specific examples from the research where this approach played a significant role, or where this approach positively impacted community engagement?
Yeah, it's a really good question, I think. And I should say, as I'm sure you already have in the introduction to this episode, that we're still very much in the thick of the risk. We're still doing it. We've still got another year and a half left. But certainly happy for some reflections of where we are now. And I think probably a good example of what we're trying to do here is around the site monitoring work that you're obviously all involved in and being pivotal, actually, in getting up and running. But that's an example where we've come together around a common problem. And that was around these particular slopes of concern for the communities where we're working. And actually, could we develop an understanding of how they're moving and the areas that are potentially at risk? And so here we brought together different knowledges and understandings of the slope and the environment, how, for example, what goes on below the subsurface, and trying to make sense of that. And we brought that into conversation with more scientific kind of understandings of landsliding and hazard, with a view to gathering our understanding, and we hope producing useful outputs that can inform local levels of planning. And so just to say a bit more about that, and this very much builds on Amy's introduction just now as well, I think. But with this work, we spent time exploring local knowledges and understandings of landscape, what's below the ground, understandings of Himalayan geology and geomorphology, how different experts of reason make sense of landscapes, things like that. We, I think really importantly, have documented the concerns and questions that rural residents have in our case study municipalities, what questions they have that we might be able to explore together. And I think also it's important to highlight that we, as a team, have tried to really understand the different expertise and perspectives that we bring to bear on this. So you've all, I know, as anthropologists, spent sort of physical sciences learning about this sort of slope monitoring equipment, what it does, how it works, and that kind of thing too. And so I guess it's an ongoing, or it's an example of something ongoing where we're bringing different expertise together to better understand how land is moving. And of course, it's taking time, right? This whole process is we're running over a series of on-scene events in an attempt to understand and bring into conversation these different understandings of the slope.
Yeah, and I think another part of the slope monitoring that like intercultural knowledge generation has helped out with and in a large way is even where we sited the slope monitoring stations. So I know that we'll get into slope monitoring, maybe not just in this episode, but in future episodes. But the locations of where those stations were put were informed by where community members told us that they understand these landslide processes really having an impact on their landscapes. So we cited these slope monitoring stations in places that the communities were indicating were really important. And they're places that for some of the physical scientists on the team or for other people who are more involved in local governance, maybe they would have selected somewhere different. But it was important for us to take on board what the community members were telling us about their knowledge of the landscape and areas that are most impactful for them. So taking those points of views is very serious and letting that kind of guide what we ended up doing in terms of siting the stations is another just small example that's not about like deep ethnographic conversations around concepts and terminologies of landscape or processes regarding landsliding, but is really about their daily experience of living with them and how that can guide what we end up doing in the science of the project.
As you both highlighted the advantages of interdisciplinary and intercultural approach to research project, I would like to ask, What challenges or barriers have you encountered when implementing an interdisciplinary intercultural research approach at Sojourn? And how have you addressed and overcome these challenges?
Well, I would start and say that even on our team, we have a huge amount of diversity of backgrounds, experiences, and nationalities and languages. And we've really developed a way of working together that honors and respects, I think, everyone's points of view and backgrounds. And so even amongst our team members ourselves, when we go out to conduct research, we're already engaging in this kind of intercultural dialogue. And I think that's really important. And this meets with the diversity that we're encountering, or the multiple communities that we're encountering in our fieldwork, who themselves think of themselves as being belonging to different cultural groups with different languages and histories that are paramount in their places. So I think for us, it's both a great benefit to the project that we bring ourselves this kind of diversity. And then we're engaging with communities from all across the Middle Hills of central Nepal, primarily, that themselves are diverse. And we have a chance to learn from many different communities rather than liaisoning and working closely with one specific community. But this, of course, can bring up its own challenges because we're talking about a country with a huge amount of linguistic diversity and language use. So there's been instances in the fieldwork where our language can be a barrier. Nepali itself as a national language is not always a language that's in use in the places that we do research. And we have to respect and work with that. And I think everyone has made great strides in creating dialogue and rapport with communities, even those that aren't predominantly Nepali speaking. And we have expertise in our project with people who speak other indigenous languages and have used that really to our advantage in the project to build trust and relationships of respect with communities. And so I would say that's both one of the positives about the project is our own cultural diversity. And then one of the challenges has always been to work across many different cultures in the context of the research that we're doing as a project.
I think it takes time, and that's something actually that's and commitment. And you know, we're certainly all committed to interdisciplinary ways of working. So actually informed by the Disaster Studies Manifesto, we've developed our own statement of project values, which is a live document that we revisit and update, and which explicitly recognizes and encourages mutual respect across disciplines. And of course, we've sought to move beyond this kind of all reductionist approach that can be associated with more siloed working. But that takes time. It takes commitment from everybody. It takes time to get to know our different approaches and understandings. And we need that kind of respect for each other and to come together. And so in fact, the COVID context for our project, we started during lockdown, which actually gave us time, I think, to spend time together in a remote space, but to get to know each other's work, to get to know our individual perspectives on things, what we bring to the project, our own expertise and knowledge and understandings in quite a productive way, I think. And it's really helped us, rather than diving straight into the field research, we've actually spent time getting to know each other and building a team that's committed to that deep interdisciplinary working and engagement. And it's not easy. I think even now, sometimes we are very respectful of each other, but I think still sometimes there are frustrations. There always will be, I think, in a project of this size. But that kind of commitment, I think, and to problem-led research that's being led very much by questions and concerns that are coming locally, be it from our partner communities around the state monitoring work or work with NGOs, UN government partners at the national level around more, for example, the scenario planning. We're being driven by those questions and concerns. And I think that's what brings us together, those questions that we then grapple with as a team.
Yes, Amy and Katie rightly highlighted the cultural diversity within the project and the community we work with. In this setting, what necessary skills and qualities that the researchers need to have to effectively engage in this kind of interdisciplinary research? And what advice will you give to aspiring researchers who are interested in incorporating interdisciplinary perspective in their work?
I think you really hit the nail on the head, Deepak. And for me, one orientation or something that needs to be taken on board when conducting this kind of research is a willingness to be uncomfortable. For someone like me who was trained as an anthropologist, but I was trained in an interdisciplinary setting, I was open to working with different people. I was very open to working with scientists, with geologists, and learning from them. but your disciplinary training is ingrained really hard. And it's really hard to stop and say, well, maybe the way that I was trained to look at this particular set of problems or this context is not always going to get me the furthest. And maybe I need to take something else on board in my thinking or my approach to this particular context or this particular problem. And so really, I think one of the first things is just a willingness to be uncomfortable and to reflect back on yourself and what and realize the limitations of what and a willingness to learn beyond that. And that can be a very difficult thing to ask everyone to do. Not everyone is comfortable doing that. And yet for this kind of research, you really, I think, have to be willing to be curious and open and willing to be challenged in order to carry it forward. So that's a really important part of this puzzle to me, is a curiosity and a willingness to get out there and put yourself in a difficult situation, to an intellectually difficult situation.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. The other thing I'd add is it can be quite messy. It's not necessarily, yeah, we want it to be an open space for kind of dialogue and discussion and grappling with things together. And so it's not always this kind of neat project. We've neatly defined the work packages and well, everyone knows exactly what they're doing, because we just sometimes have to throw that out of the window, actually, and come together and be led by the problem and talk it through and brainstorm together. And there we go down some, or take the wrong turn, should I say, and some things take longer than we think, or there might be some minor disagreements in the team. But respect is really important, and being open to learning from each other and breaking down those kind of hierarchies, intellectual hierarchies, I think, but also just recommending and respecting everyone on the team, regardless of their stage, etc., I think is really important too.
Yeah, and I would also add, because Deepak, you brought up language, and I think that's absolutely important when we're talking about communication in a lot of ways, communication across disciplines and communication across culture as we generate knowledge together. So part of, I think, a challenge and a real opportunity of this kind of research is learning to speak another language, whether that's a language of a different scientific discipline or the language of a community that you're working with, and really being able to use the ways that people are daily thinking about the problems that you as someone from outside the community is there to help them explore and work through. So language is really key here too. And I would really encourage language as something that's important for this kind of research.
Thank you, Katie and Amy, for your time, sharing your experience of working in an interdisciplinary and intercultural research project that is Sachak Nepal, and most importantly, highlighting the importance of such approach in research. Thank you once again.
Thank you both.
I was also thinking about one of our conversations with Anuradha, where she shared an excerpt from her interview with our Khaki woman about duality of understanding of hazards and what causes those hazards. Considering the diversity across Nepal and our field sites, one approach we have tried to understand hazards and risks is through the plurality of worldviews that encompasses phenomena, including hazard occurrences and its explanations. In our respective field site, we have found that people hold both spiritual and scientific views in tandem. I think this excerpt from Dholakar is illustrative and provides a good glimpse of the plurality of understanding we are trying to capture.
Yes, that excerpt is a great example. I clearly remember the conversation, which not only sets light on the plurality of worldviews people hold in relation to hazard and disaster, but also questions the scientific understanding of earthquakes by challenging the inability of scientific experts to predict earthquake prior to their occurrence. I think we should play the clip from the interview. It will provide a good glimpse to our listeners about the plurality of worldviews and hazard occurrences.
Our ancestors talked about the fish. According to our father, a gigantic fish lives in a large pond underneath the earth's surface. And when the fish moves its whiskers slightly, it immediately causes the earth to tremble. We've heard from them that if the fish changes its side, then the entire land would go upside down. We've also heard scientists say that earthquakes occur due to the disarrangement of the plates. It is said that the plates have gone up and down, and to make the adjustment of the plates, the ground shakes. We've been experiencing aftershocks since the last big earthquake. How can we decide whether the scientist or our ancestor is right in their explanation? If we agree with what the scientist is saying, then the scientist should know prior to the occurrence of an earthquake. Why did they not know? They only inform us after it occurs. In this regard, I think what our ancestors said about the vicious movements being behind the earthquake is right.
I think Kaki Uman raised an interesting point. She contemplates the movement of a gigantic fish underneath the earth as a cause of earthquakes and moves between the scientific explanation and the folklore of fish movement passed down from her ancestors. I think that's a good place to end this episode. In the next episode, Anuradha and Teg will go to some of our field sites to talk about local practices for anticipating and living with cascading hazards and the science of a landslide monitoring that is being explored with communities.
Well, thank you all for being with us today. And before you go, a few quick reminders about how you can stay connected with the podcast.
You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at DisastersDecon.
The podcast is available on all the major platforms. Please download, share, and most importantly, subscribe.
And if you haven't already done this, we really appreciate your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. This will help us to continue making content for you.
You've been listening to Disasters Deconstructed. And don't forget, disasters are not natural. See you next time.